trees, and the tunnel filled with the spring warbling of birds.
"Do you hear that, Tungdil? Gerdlegard is wishing you well," said Frala, filling her lungs with fresh air. "What glorious weather for a journey."
The dwarf lingered for a moment in the safety of the shaded doorway. He was accustomed to having ceilings above him and walls that afforded protection on all sides. In the open, there was too much freedom for his liking, and he had to acclimate himself all over again. Not wanting Frala to think he was no braver than a gnome, he took a deep breath, stepped out into the sunshine above Ionundar, and marched purposefully away.
"Come back soon, Tungdil," she called.
He turned and waved until the doors to the vaults were closed, then continued on his way. After a few paces, he came to a halt. Screwing up his eyes, he winced in the dazzling light. His subterranean existence had made him so sensitive to the sun's powerful rays that he was obliged to shelter in the shade of a towering oak. He dropped onto the grass and laid the Magus's bag and his pack of provisions beside him.
Not the most promising start, he thought to himself.
He squinted at his surroundings, straining to see something of the landscape. The canopy of leaves afforded little protection from the glare. It was the same at the beginning of every journey, but at least the terrain, a wide track winding gently over rolling countryside, would be easily mastered on foot. He held the map above his head to block out the light and studied his route. Assuming the cartographer knew his business, the landscape would begin to change in the region of the Black Saddle. A dense forest of pines surrounded the mountain, through which there was no obvious path.
"So much the better."
Tungdil ran his thumb over the blade of his axe.
"Those trees will regret it if they get in my way."
The sun followed its slow trajectory across the sky. Little by little, Tungdil's eyes adjusted to the sunshine as it weakened and mellowed to a soft orange glow. By dusk, his vision would be restored entirely, but time was running out if he wanted to cover a few miles and find a bed before nightfall. Straightening up determinedly, he slung his packs on his back, returned his axe to his belt, and plodded on, all the while cursing the sunshine. Grumbling wouldn't get him there any faster, but it vastly improved his mood. The sun was disappearing over the crest of a hill when Tungdil emerged from the forest on the fifth orbit of his uneventful journey and found himself confronted by palisades bounding a village of some considerable size. Two soldiers patrolled the wooden watchtower above the gateway. At first, neither noticed the diminutive figure outside, but at last one of the men motioned to his companion. Judging by their reaction, the dwarf was not regarded as a threat. Tungdil was relieved. After four chilly nights in the open, camped among squirrels, foxes, and more greenery than he could tolerate, he was looking forward to finding a tavern with good beer, warm food, and a soft mattress. His stomach was grumbling already. He reached the gateway, but the doors remained closed. The sentries leaned over the parapet and watched from above.
"Good evening to you both," he bellowed up at them. "Be so kind as to open the gates. I should like a bed for the night and a roof overhead."
Even from a distance, he could tell that their armor was well made and well cared for. This led him to two conclusions. First, the suits had been crafted by a smith of considerable skill, and second, the metal was worn for protection and not effect. The sentries were no ordinary villagers. These thoughts were followed by another revealing discovery. In the flickering torchlight, he had taken the rounded objects on the palisades to be gargoyles, but on closer inspection, they turned out to be skulls. The heads of three dozen dead orcs were impaled on the defenses. Tungdil doubted the wisdom of baiting the enemy in this fashion. As a deterrent, an array of orcish skulls had about as much chance of warding off the orcs as a dead bird would protect a field from crows. In fact, the sight of the severed heads was more likely to incite the brutes to wholesale slaughter. From this, Tungdil deduced that he had crossed the border into Eiderslane, and that the men hired to defend the settlement were trained fighters, but foolhardy with it. Only mercenaries paid by the skull would be reckless enough to provoke the beasts so gruesomely. The bloodied heads had been set out as bait to draw in nearby bands of orcs.
"What are you waiting for?" he called indignantly. "Let me in!" "Greetings, groundling. This is good water in the fair land of Eiderslane. Have you sighted orcs on your travels?" No!
He shouted, struggling to keep his temper. To be referred to as a groundling was more than he could bear.
And if you don't mind, I'm no more a groundling than you men are grasslings. I'm a dwarf.
The sentries laughed. At their signal, the right half of the double door creaked open, and Tungdil was allowed to pass. Inside, another pair of heavily armed soldiers was waiting for him. They eyed him distrustfully.
Well, blow me down, one of them muttered. If it isn't a real-life dwarf. They're not as tiny as everyone says they are.
Tungdil was once again reminded that humans knew almost nothing about dwarves. He bristled under the sentry's stares.
If you've quite finished gawking, maybe one of you could inform me where I might find a bed.
The sentries directed him to the nearest tavern, which lay a short distance along the dusty street. Above the door, a shabby platter and a similarly dilapidated tankard indicated that the place sold food and beer, although by the look of it, it wouldn't be anything fancy. In spite of his best efforts to slip in unseen, the rusty hinges squealed excitedly as soon as he lifted the wooden crossbar and pushed open the door. It was hard to imagine a simpler yet more effective means of guarding against intruders. The shriek of neglected metal was impossible to ignore. The dwarf hesitated for a moment, then entered. Seated at the tavern's roughly fashioned tables were 10 villagers, holding tankards of ale or mead. Tungdil's nose was assailed immediately by the smell of food, combined with tobacco and sweat. The villagers wore simple garments, hessian or coarse woolen shirts to protect against the evening chill. Their feet were encased in thick stockings and laced shoes. Two of the men nodded hesitantly in acknowledgement. The others were too busy staring. It was always the same. The dwarf returned the greeting and took his place at an empty table. Naturally, the furniture was far too big for him, but he made himself comfortable and ordered his supper and a large ale. In no time, a steaming plate of cornmeal and mincemeat was laid in front of him, followed by a tankard of beer. He tucked in ravenously. The meal tasted wholesome, a little burned and somewhat bland, but at least it was warm. The pale, watery beer disappointed his dwarven palate, but he drank it all the same. He had no desire to cause offence, especially when there was the matter of his lodgings still to settle. One of the villagers was looking at him so intently that he could almost feel his piercing stare. Tungdil returned his gaze unflinchingly.
"What beats me,"
said the man, raising his voice so everyone in the tavern could hear,
"is what a groundling would be doing in our village."
A ring of smoke left his pipe and shot toward the sooty ceiling.
"Breaking his journey."
Tungdil chewed his mouthful deliberately, dropped his spoon into the gloop, and wiped his beard. A belligerent villager was the last thing he needed. It was obvious from his manner that the man was sparring for a fight.
Well, he's picked the wrong dwarf.
"I've no desire to argue with you, estimable sir," he said firmly. "I've spent the past few nights in the open, and vracus willing, I'd like to sleep on something other than twigs and leaves."
There was an eruption of mocking laughter. Some of the villagers prostrated themselves in front of the pipe smoker, calling him Sir and Your Honour. One even went so far as to set an empty tankard like a crown on his head. They evidently found it amusing that Tungdil should address a humble villager in terms of respect.
"You think you're quite something, don't you, groundling?"
The man hurled the tankard to the floor and faced his friends angrily.
"Go ahead and laugh, you hare-brained idiots. What if he was sent by orcs to spy on us? You won't find it so funny when he sneaks out of bed and opens the gates."
The mirth stopped abruptly. At once, Tungdil realized he would have to tread carefully. On a practical level, that meant sticking to plain speech. It was bad enough that he was a dwarf, let alone a dwarf with fancy manners.
"Dwarves and orcs are sworn enemies," he said earnestly. "A dwarf would never throw in his lot with an orc."
He extended his hand toward the man.
"Here, have my word that I mean you no harm. I swear it by Vracus, creator of all dwarves."
The villager stared at the sturdy fingers and weighed the matter in his mind. At last, he gave the hand a brief shake and turned away. The publican brought the relieved Tungdil another beer.
"Don't mind him," he said quickly. "We're all on edge at the moment.
So many villages have been plundered these past few orbits. Orcs are rampaging through the northwest of Idoslane.
Hence the mercenaries at the gates.
They're here to protect us until King Tilagorn's soldiers rid us of the beasts.
He turned to go.
Wait!
Tungdil laid a hand on his grease-spotted sleeve. The man's words had given him faint grounds for hope.
Will there be dwarves among them? I heard King Tilagorn has dwarves in his pay.
The publican shrugged.
I couldn't tell you, little fellow, but it wouldn't surprise me.
When do they get here?
He asked eagerly. The opportunity of setting eyes on a fellow dwarf was reason enough to delay his mission to the Black Saddle.
All the more potatoes for Jolasin to peel. By rights, they should have been here 3 orbits ago,
said the publican, signalling apologetically to the queue of thirsty customers at the bar. Tungdil let him go and returned to his supper, mulling over what he knew of Tilagorn and his kingdom. The name Idoslane was derived from the land's bloody past. At the heart of the historical conflict was the throne. The Idos, the kingdom's great ruling dynasty, had plotted, conspired, and waged war on one another, bringing misery on themselves and their people, who bore the brunt of their feuds. Bit by bit, the state was torn apart by their squabbling, until every district was governed by a different member of the Ido clan. At last, their subjects reached the limit of their endurance and felled every last sibling, cousin, and scion of the dynasty. Ido slain. A villager, rather the worse for wear, staggered to his feet and raised his tankard.
Long live Prince Malin! May he drive King Tilagorn from the throne!
When no one joined in with his toast, he lowered himself to his stool, muttering darkly. If Tungdil's memory served him correctly, Prince Malin was the sole surviving member of the Ido clan. He lived in exile in Urgon, the kingdom to the north of Idoslane, and was forever conspiring to return to his country as its rightful king. Tacked to the wall of the tavern was an ancient map of Idoslane, its yellowed parchment stained by smoke. The succession of rolling hills, forests, and plains made for a pleasantly varied landscape. It would have been idyllic if it weren't for the orcs.
Not a bad place, is it?
Observed a fellow drinker, following Tungdil's gaze.
Save for Toboribor.
Tungdil pointed to the black enclave at the heart of the kingdom. The orcish stronghold was located on Idoslane's most fertile land. He picked up his tankard and joined the villager at his table.
Why are the brutes on the move?
They're bored, that's all. Orcs don't need a reason to plunder and pillage. They attacked a place a few miles from here and set fire to the fields and orchards. Their sort are just monsters, robbing, fighting, killing. They don't know any better.
And they're strong,
said another, eyes widening theatrically.
There was a time when...
Not that old fable,
groaned the publican, stopping at the table to refill their tankards.
You don't have to listen. I was talking to the dwarf.
In spite of his injured tone, the storyteller had no intention of abandoning his tale.
I came up against a whole bedeviled mob of them. Great hulking beasts they were. It was during my employ in Tilagorn's army.
Happier times they were. The old prattler never had time to scare folks with his stories.
What would a publican know about it? If you'd seen the accursed things, you'd have some respect.
He turned back to Tungdil.
I'm telling you, dwarf, they were a terrible sight. A whole head taller than most men and ugly as sin. Big flat noses, hideous eyes and sticking out teeth. It was worse for the young lads. They nearly died of fright.
That's funny, murmured Tungdil. I read a description just like that in... He clamped his mouth shut, but no one had heard. To cover his embarrassment, he scratched his sunburned head. Any later in the season and his scalp would have burned to a crisp by now. The sun took a bit of getting used to.
Half an orbit it took to kill those wretched brutes. My, they were tough. When I was young, no one would hire mercenaries to keep the orcs from their gates. Orcs or no orcs, Idoslane was safe in our hands. Times have changed,
he said regretfully, mourning the decline of Tilagorn's army and the passing of his youth. He glanced down and caught sight of Tungdil's axe. The blade had been put to good use in the woods and was looking somewhat neglected, with blobs of dried sap and splinters sticking to the bit.
Don't tell me you've been using a fine axe like that for hacking wood,
he exclaimed, aghast. I had to get through the undergrowth somehow. Tungdil reddened, hoping to goodness that no one would ask him to demonstrate his race's legendary axemanship. The truth was, he knew nothing of fighting. Tungdil had learned everything he knew from Lot Ionan, who took little interest in weaponry, sword fights, and close combat, leaving his ward without a military education. No one had ever shown him how to wield an axe in anger. The servants chopped wood or killed rats with their axes, and that was as far as his handling of the feared dwarven weapon went. His race was supposed to be skilled in axemanship, but if faced with an aggressor, which well he might be, he was resigned to striking out haphazardly and praying that the beast would run away.
"The dwarves are great warriors, so I've heard," said the veteran trooper. "Runs in the blood, does it? Is it true what they say about a single dwarf putting pay to a pack of 10 orcs?
Tungdil had long suspected that he wasn't a proper dwarf, but now his fears were confirmed. Listening to the men made him realize that his kinsfolk would laugh if they could see him, which put an end to his enthusiasm for meeting others of his race. Even the thought of the fairer sex seemed more alarming than appealing.
10 orcs, he said, hoping the trooper was right. "Absolutely."
He yawned loudly, stretched, and rose. It was time to escape his own doubts, shake off his nosy questioners, and find a bed.
"You'll have to excuse me. I need to get some sleep."
His fellow drinkers, their initial suspicions forgotten, were reluctant to let him go, but at length he was permitted to make his way to the second floor of the timber frame house, where the publican had quartered him for the night. The room was a dormitory, but a large one, and Tungdil had it to himself. He used the washbowl to bathe his sweaty feet, which had been confined to his boots since the start of the journey. Savoring the luxury of his third beer, he stood by the window and gazed out over the tiled roofs of Goodwater. The settlement was a good size, numbering 1,000 or so dwellings. The villagers seemed to make their living from the surrounding fields and orchards, and what wealth they had was now threatened by orcs. Tilogorn's anxiously awaited army would have to hurry if there was going to be anything left to save. Tungdil dried his weary feet, folded his clothes over a chair, and buried himself in the thick feather duvet. Silvery light shone on the leather bag destined for Gorin, sorely testing his resolve.
"Don't meddle with things that don't concern you," he told himself sternly.
Even as he fell asleep, he thought of Lot Ionan and Frala, whose talisman was looped through his belt. He missed the sound of her laughter. Tomorrow he would ask the publican for directions to the Black Saddle, and press on without delay. Muffled sounds roused him from his sleep. Two men were taking great pains to ready themselves for bed without making any noise. Outside, a storm was howling and raging around the settlement. A whispered exchange followed, during which Tungdil felt certain that he heard Lot Ionan's name. He peered warily at the newcomers. A thin, well-dressed gentleman and a taller, broader fellow, clad in leather mail with metal plating.
A merchant and his bodyguard?
Their garments were clearly worth a gold piece or two. He caught sight of a simple yet striking trinket attached to the larger fellow's leather lapel. It was embossed with the seal of the Magi.
"They're envoys to the Magi's council.
Are you headed for Ionundar?"
he asked, abandoning all pretense of sleep. Curiosity had triumphed over caution. The broad man frowned.
"What makes you think that?"
"Well, the brooch."
He pointed to the man's gown.
"You must be envoys."
The pair exchanged looks of surprise.
"Who are you?"
the bearer of the trinket demanded. Tungdil introduced himself.
"What news of Lot Ionan?"
the man said sharply.
"Is he well?"
"Perhaps you could tell me a little about yourselves first," the dwarf requested with impeccable politeness.
They supplied him with their names and occupations. Fridigard, a first-tier Famulus apprentice to Turgur the Fair-Faced, and Vrabor, a warrior in the service of the Magi.
"Lot Ionan is in excellent health," Tungdil informed them. "You'll see for yourselves when you get there."
He struggled to contain himself, then gave in.
"Pray, what is the—"
He reconsidered and began more plainly. "What do you want with the Magus?"
"Our business is with Lot Ionan, not his message boy," Vrabor
said dismissively, loosening the buckles on his armor. Why do you think the council sent an envoy and not a town crier? He had barely finished speaking when the storm outside whipped into a frenzy, gusting through chinks in the walls and emitting a strange, unnatural whine, which was followed almost immediately by a high-pitched whistle. Tensing, the two men reached for their swords.
Not a night to be abroad, thought the dwarf as he watched the moonlit scraps of cloud chase across the gloomy sky.
Just then, a slender face appeared at the window. Tungdil looked into the grey-green eyes and felt his mind go numb. The apparition was more bewitching than frightening. Long, dark hair swept the beautiful visage, the occasional strand plastered against the rain-drenched skin. So pale, so perfect was the being, that it resembled a marble sculpture of an elf, its bedraggled locks like fine fractures in the stone. The dwarf stared helplessly, transfixed by the creature's gaze. The countenance was attractive. Of that there was no question. But it inspired in him an almost physical revulsion. It was too beautiful, almost cruelly so.
Over there!
His breathless warning was enough to alert the envoys, who looked up and dove for cover. At that moment, there was an explosion of glass as a long black-fletched arrow shattered the window and whined through the air, planting itself in the wall.
You get rid of them! I'll deal with the window!
Shouted Vrabor to his companion. Seizing the heavy table, he upturned it and slammed it into the wall, then hurriedly jammed some furniture against the makeshift barricade. There were no other openings for arrows to enter. Meanwhile, Fridegard, eyes closed and head bowed, was chanting silently and tracing strange symbols in the air. In his right hand was a coin-sized crystal set in gold.
Can someone tell me what's going on?
Tungdil scrambled out of bed and grabbed his axe because it made him feel safer. The envoys listened in silence. Although the wind had abated, the rain was falling more heavily than before. They strained their ears, but there was no sound of the mysterious bowman. He seemed to have vanished with the tempest.
Has the elf gone?
I can't be sure, said Vrabor. Perhaps.
He sheathed his sword and sat down on the bed, hands resting on the crossguard of his weapon.
They could be biding their time.
They?
Alfar, two of them. They've been tailing us since Porista.
So it wasn't an elf after all.
The Alfar, a race crueler than any other, were sworn enemies of the elves. They hated their cousins for their purity, a purity that the Alfar themselves had been denied. It was hatred and jealousy, according to the history books, that impelled them across the Northern Pass and into Gerdlegard.
Is Lotionen in danger?
Lotionen will come to no harm, Vrabor assured him wearily. The Elfar are powerless against the Magi, and they know it. The arrow was meant for Fridegard and me. They want to know what we're carrying. We knew they were following us as soon as we left the capital of Leos Nudin, but they waited until they could be sure of our destination before they attacked. I'm sorry, Groundling, he said, responding to the unspoken question in Tungdil's eyes. I'm sure you're a loyal messenger, and I know we're indebted to your vigilance, but our business is between the Council and Lotionen. You'll have to save your questions for your return.
I'm a dwarf, not a groundling. Tungdil toyed with the idea of accompanying the envoys to Ionandar the next morning, and telling the Magus of what he had seen, but he decided against it. His mission to the Black Saddle was more important. He sat down and laid his axe across his knees. The rest of the night was spent in watchful silence, their fear of the Alfar keeping tiredness at bay. None of them slept a wink, but Fridegard's spell seemed to have worked, and there was no sign of their assailants. At last, with the coming of dawn, the tension finally fell away, and Tungdil lay back and dozed. Chapter 3 Enchanted Realm of Ionandar, Gerdlegard, late spring, 6,234th solar cycle. Reclining in his wing chair with his feet on a stool, Lotionen had made himself comfortable in a corner of his study, and was leafing contentedly through a grimoire, one of the many that lined his walls. In addition to his slightly shabby beige robes, he wore even shabbier slippers, and his pipe lay beside him, tobacco at the ready. Steam rose from a glass of herbal tea on the table. The Magus was savoring the peace and quiet.
Do you hear that, Nula?
he asked the barn owl, who was perched on the back of his chair and seemed to be studying his spells.
Not a sound. No noise. No explosions. I was loath to say goodbye to Tungdil, but I know it was the right decision.
Blinking approvingly, Nula replied with a gentle twit-twoo. Lot Iona knew full well that she couldn't understand him, but he enjoyed their conversations. It was an excellent way of collecting his thoughts.
I suppose it was a bit mean of me, really,
he confessed.
Goreen left the Black Saddle goodness knows how many cycles ago. He abandoned the mountain after falling for the charms of a beautiful and intelligent elf.
The owl blinked again.
Well, you want to know how I heard about it? My former apprentice told me himself. It was all in a letter that he wrote from Greenglade. He seemed most contented with his new abode, and gave a full account of the superior allure of elven women.
The thought of Gareen's mistress reminded Lot Ionin of his age. He had long since lost interest in pleasures of the flesh. Other matters took precedence in his mind.
Tungdil will find out his new address, I shouldn't wonder. And when he does, he won't rest until he's tracked Gareen down and accomplished his errand.
He took a sip from his steaming glass. The cold air of the vaults was conducive to study, but he found himself drinking countless cups of tea. Nula blinked, this time almost reproachfully.
What?
He said defensively.
Don't you remember how he and Jolicin ruined my work? You know how fond I am of Tungdil, but another incident of that kind while I'm rewriting the formula would be disastrous. I took the necessary measures to ensure a lengthy absence, that's all.
The owl seemed unconvinced.
Come on, the journey will do him good. After everything he's read about Gerdlegard, it's time he saw the country for himself. Besides, he'll be back before you know it, pleased as punch for finding Goreen on his own. And as for Jolicin, he'll never want to look at another potato, let alone eat one, and he'll be cured of playing tricks. We'll all be better off in the long run.
His eyes fell on his solar calendar.
What's that I see? Nula, we're expecting an important guest.
The circular slide rule indicated that Nudeen, the Knowledge Lusty, would be visiting that orbit. Needless to say, his fellow wizard would not be putting in a personal appearance. With 500 or more miles separating their realms, they communicated via magic, availing themselves of an elaborate ritual that could be implemented only during certain phases of the moon. Not that Lot Ionin minded the distance. Nudeen was fast developing into the most disagreeable character that Lot Ionin had ever known. At the same time, he was becoming a formidable magus, his growing skill as a wizard correlating almost exactly with his objectionableness as a man. Of course, everyone developed his own personal approach to studying the mystic arts, but only Nudeen seemed to think that being rude, bad-tempered, arrogant, and overweight would somehow serve his cause.
I'll be honest with you, Nula. That man has spells and charms at his fingertips that others could barely decipher, let alone perform.
He reached under the table and fished out a jug of water and a glass. After giving the latter a quick polish on his robes, he held it critically in the candlelight. There were those who said that Nudeen's rising power as a magus had not been gained through study and hard work. Rumor had it that he had cast a spell on his body and invested it with the ability to retain magic indefinitely. Lot Ionin gave the gossip no credence, but even he was forced to concede that Nudeen had changed in character and appearance. At that moment, the air cooled suddenly, and a fierce gust of wind swept through the room, nearly extinguishing the candles. A faint bluish haze shimmered at the center of the study, gradually assuming the contours of a man. In the span of a few heartbeats, Lot Ionin found himself staring at Nudeen's imposing bulk. The wizard of Ionanda appraised his dark-robed guest. Nudeen seemed to have grown again, outward as well as upward. His paunch looked larger than before, which was possibly the reason for his especially voluminous malachite green robes. Chin-length mousy hair hung limply about his face, and there were dark circles around his usually lively green eyes. The apparition was a perfect replica of the real magician, who at that moment was standing in the circle he had cast in his study in Parista, working the magic for his doppelganger to appear. The illusion was incredible. Lotionen had never seen a more perfect demonstration of the phenomenon in all his 287 cycles. Apparitions usually shimmered slightly or were marred by minor imperfections, but this one was complete. Nudin, holding a finely carved maple staff crowned with an impressive onyx in his left hand, languidly dusted his elegant robes with his right, dispatching the lingering blue sparks. Suddenly, Lotionen felt terribly underdressed.
"Do sit down," he said, gesturing to an armchair, and Nudin's doppelganger lowered himself smoothly into the seat.
Convention dictated that the same courtesies were extended to apparitions as to real guests. It was only polite.
"Can I offer you a drop of tea, or would you like something else?"
The question was not as absurd as it sounded. Even from a distance of 500 miles, Nudin would be able to taste the flavor of anything consumed by his doppelganger. The visitor shook his head.
"Thank you, my friend, but the news I bring will suffer no delay. You must come to Leos Nudin at once. The perished land is advancing."
Lotionen stopped smiling. He had not prepared himself for tidings as dire as these.
"How long has it been moving?"
"Some 60 orbits. I took a trip to the border and it came to my attention."
Nudin looked anxious.
"Our protective girdle is no longer as strong and reliable as it was. The damage is too great for me to repair. I need the Council's help. The rest of us are in Leos Nudin already. We're waiting for you."
He trailed off.
"Go on,"
Lotionen encouraged him, although he had a sinking feeling that there was worse to come.
"It's the Alpha," explained Nudin. "They've been sighted in the south of Gauragar, many miles from Jean Balzur. Meanwhile, King Tilogorn is being plagued by marauding orcs. They're rampaging through Eidoslane, burning down villages and laying waste to the land. He sent his army to deal with them."
He looked grimly at his host.
"It bodes ill, Lotionen."
"The incursion of the perished land, the Elfar, the orcs, they're all connected?"
"We certainly shouldn't rule it out,"
he said, refusing to commit himself.
"You were summoned by the Magi's council. Why didn't you respond?"
"Summoned?"
Lotionen made no attempt to disguise his surprise.
"When?"
"I have it on good authority that two of the council's best envoys were dispatched with a message. Fredegard and Vrabor are their names. I believe you know them."
"Of course I know them. But where have they got to?"
Lotionen was instantly concerned for the pair's well-being, especially now the Alfar were known to be abroad.
"Thank goodness you decided to follow it up yourself. I'll set off as soon as I can. It shouldn't take more than a few orbits to get to Leos Nudin."
Lotionen expected Nudin to take his leave, but the apparition did not stir.
"Just one more thing," his guest cut in. "It's trivial compared to the other news, but all the same. Do you think you could bring my instruments with you? If you've finished with them, I'd very much like to have them back."
"Your instruments, of course."
Many cycles ago, Lotionen had borrowed a number of items from Nudin, on Gorin's behalf. The loan comprised a small handheld mirror, 2 arm-length remnants of sigodaisy wood, and a pair of silver-plated glass carafes with unusual etchings. After finding some reference to the items in a compendium, Gorin had been eager to examine them more closely. Lotionen could no longer recall what conclusion he had reached, but he suspected it was nothing of particular interest. The more immediate problem was locating the things. He had a sudden vision of the wrecked laboratory and hoped to goodness that Gorin had not left the items there.
"I'll be sure to bring them," he promised.
Nudin seemed doubtful.
"You do still have them, don't you?"
Lotionen nodded in what he hoped was a convincing fashion.
"All right, we'll make haste, old friend. Only the full council can save Girdlegard from the terrors to come."
Nudin's double rose to his feet, positioned himself in the middle of the room, and wrapped his staff firmly against the floor. The illusion shattered in a shower of sparks. Glittering dust drizzled to the ground, disintegrating further and further until nothing was left. The interview ended as spectacularly as it had begun. Lotionen leaned back in his chair.
"If Taboribor's orcs have joined forces with Jean Balseur's Elfar, the peoples of Girdlegard are in serious danger."
He decided to combine his trip to Leos Nudin with a visit to King Tilogorn in order to pledge his support. At least half of Ionandar lay within the borders of Eidoslane, so it seemed only proper to loan the monarch his magical powers in the battle against Teon's brutes. The Magus rose.
Time is of the essence. Nudin was right.
He summoned his Famuli and issued instructions regarding the luggage he required for the journey, and the chain of command among the students while he was away. Then he removed his beloved robes and exchanged them reluctantly for his little-worn travelling garb, comprising another set of robes, also in beige, but made of more durable cloth, and a mantle of dark blue leather. His servants were busy grooming his bay stallion, Furo. The 500-mile journey to Paristo would take 10 orbits at most, so everything he needed could be stowed in the saddlebags. At length, Lotionan clambered somewhat stiffly onto his horse. Furo snorted excitedly as the Magus leaned forward, stroked its mane, and whispered some enchantment in its ear. With a loud whinny, the stallion thundered out of the underground vaults and through the gates. Once out in the open, with the path ahead and fresh air all around, it picked up speed, accelerating from a canter to a gallop. The cobbles flashed beneath its hooves, covering multiple paces with each stride. Thanks to Lotionan's art, the horse could outstrip any mount in Girdlegard, and it relished its speed. And thus Furo carried his master, who was clinging on for dear life, across Ionandar and beyond. Kingdom of Gauragar, Girdlegard, late spring, 6,234th solar cycle.
The Black Saddle? Never heard of it.
The morning could scarcely have got off to a less auspicious start. Tungdil pushed the map to one side as the publican placed his breakfast on the table. Particles of dust danced in the wide rays of sunshine pouring through the plate glass windows. It came as a relief to Tungdil that he could see without peering. His eyes had adjusted to the brightness already. None of the good people of Eidoslane could tell him anything about the Black Saddle. It was not even marked on the tavern's ancient map. "Is there anyone in Goodwater who could help me?" he persisted. "A clerk or a magistrate or someone?" The publican shook his head regretfully, sorry to disappoint the outsider. Tungdil spooned his breakfast half-heartedly. The porridge was decent enough, but frustration had taken the edge off his hunger. Privately, he was still hoping that the villagers were too simple-minded to be relied on. The publican struck him as the sort who had never strayed more than 10 or 20 miles from home. Annoyingly, Goodwater was not marked either, but with a bit of luck, one of the mercenaries would know the area sufficiently well to pinpoint its location and send him in the right direction. No doubt Fridegard and Vrabor would have been of some assistance, but they had long since departed. Stopping only to give the publican a few gold coins to pay for the window, they had struck out for Ionandar and taken the arrow with them. Tungdil was similarly anxious to leave.
"Vrakis be with you,"
he called to the publican as he slung his pack and leather bag over his shoulder and stepped out into the street. The sentries from the previous night had been replaced with a new set of stubbly faces, but Tungdil lost no time in inquiring about the Black Saddle. Thankfully, the mercenaries had heard of the wretched mountain and could point to Goodwater on the map. It was getting on for midday when he left the settlement and set off down a narrow road, heading north as the sentries had advised.
"If you see any orcs, tell them where they can find their dead friends,"
one of the men shouted after him, thrusting his spear at a festering skull and raising a cloud of flies. He could still hear the soldiers' laughter as he skirted the fields that he had seen in the distance from his window the night before. Goodwater was an apt name for the place. Tungdil could picture what it would be like at harvest time. Fields of corn blowing gently in the breeze, ripe apples hanging from the branches, and enough nuts for countless busy hands. Eidoslane struck him as a beautiful place, with the obvious limitation that it wasn't underground. He never felt quite comfortable in the open.
"At least there's a decent road."
He dreaded the moment when he would have to strike out across the countryside.
"It's beyond me how the pointy ears manage to find their bearings when there's nothing but woods and fields."
From what he'd gathered from his reading, the elves had retreated to the glades of Alandur as part of their quest to live in harmony with nature, art, and beauty. But the smug creature's desire for perfection had failed to save them from their treacherous cousins, the Alfar. It's funny, thought Tungdil, remembering the face at the window. The Alf looked just the way I always imagined an elf. The northern elven kingdom of Lesintiel had fallen long ago, and now the kingdom of Alandur was two-thirds under the dominion of the perished land. As for the elves of the Golden Plains, they were history. The Alfar had seized their land, renamed it Jon Balsur, and made it their base, from which they sent out scouts to reconnoiter the surrounding land of Garagar. Garagar's sovereign, King Bruron, was powerless to repel them. As warriors, men were no match for the Alfar, and if it came to a battle, Bruron's soldiers would be lucky to draw their weapons before they were killed. Tungdil thought of the envoys and tried to estimate the distance between the southeasterly tip of Jon Balsur in the north and Lot Eonan's vaults in the south. 400 miles or more, he reckoned, a formidable distance even for an elf. Unless, of course, the perished land has edged southward and the Alfar have extended their range. If that was the case, it would explain the envoy's business with Lot Eonan. Any expansion southward of the perished land would pose a threat to the enchanted realm of Leos Nudin. Tungdil kept a watchful eye on his surroundings as he walked. If there were orcs abroad, he had no desire to deliver himself into their clutches. He took particular care at blind corners, stopping to listen for clunking armor and weaponry, or bestial snarls and shouts. To his considerable relief, he encountered no one, and was spared the unenviable task of choosing to stand his ground or flee the orc's superior might. By the time he reached the gaily painted pickets marking the border between Eidoslane and Garagar, it had been dark for about 4 hours. His feet were weary, so he decided to journey no farther that night. Spotting a nearby oak, he walked over and scrambled into the branches, hauling his bags after him with a rope that he had purchased in Goodwater. He valued his life sufficiently that sleeping like a bird in the treetops seemed a fair price to pay for the extra protection it afforded. The orcs were hardly likely to spot him, and in the event of trouble, he would draw on his ingenuity to find a way out. Wrapping the rope twice around his body, he tied himself to the tree to stop himself from falling or being shaken from his perch, then closed his eyes and dreamed. He took a deep breath, filling his lungs with the fresh, cold air that swept the majestic summits of the Great Blade and Dragon's Tongue. The northern pass appeared before him, and his imagination took off, soaring high above the grey range like an eagle. A sudden welter of monstrous shouts shattered the serenity of the mountains and echoed hideously against the age-old rock. On looking down, Tungdil saw the mighty portals of the stone gateway, and all around them Giselbert and the fifthlings fighting to the death. Axes thudded into enemy armor, biting through sinew and bone, only to be torn out and planted in the next foe. Still the hordes kept coming. Tungdil stared in dismay when he saw the endless tide of assailants battering the stronghold. A foul stench of dead orc rose from the battlements, where the stone was awash with green blood. He could practically taste the rancid fat on the creature's greasy armor. The reek was so unbearable that he woke up, retching. Tungdil opened his eyes and was surprised to discover that it was light. What? At the foot of the tree, a dozen fires were burning in a ring. Guttural laughter, low grunts, snarls, and angry curses sounded from below. His blood ran cold. He was trapped. The bands of orcs, so eagerly awaited by Goodwater's mercenaries, had set up camp around his tree. No wonder he had dreamed of the Fifthling's battle against the hordes. His ears had heard the brutes, his nostrils had smelled them, and his sleeping mind had conjured the images to fit. The dwarf pressed himself against the trunk, stiff as a statue, willing himself to become part of the tree.
What if they notice me?
One thing was certain. A mob of this size would make short work of the handful of mercenaries in Goodwater. Red flames blazed up from the fires, towering as high as several lances and alerting nighttime wanderers to the danger. For the dwarf amid the boughs, the warning came too late. Tungdil totted up the heads in sight, and came to the conclusion that over 100 beasts were camped below. Sturdy, powerful orcs, for whom a wooden palisade would be no deterrent if there was prey on the other side. He took another look, and was seized with the urge to vomit. The meat being roasted over the fires and consumed with gusto was unmistakably human in form. Two human torsos were turning on specially constructed racks like chickens on a spit. Tungdil had to fight back his nausea. It didn't take a genius to work out that the beast's suspicions would be aroused by a porridge-spewing tree. Judging by the color of the bandages, he deduced that the ragged strips of cloth covering the wounds of the handful of injured orcs had been torn from the uniforms of King Tilogorn's men. So much for Goodwater's eagerly awaited reinforcements. It seemed Ida Slane's soldiers had underestimated the strength of the enemy and paid a high price, having been killed and eaten into the bargain.
Out of the frying pan and into the fire, thought Tungdil,
remembering the previous night's brush with the Elfar.
What have I done to deserve this?
The poor villagers of Goodwater had no idea that the green-hided peril was heading their way. He was the only one who could warn them. But that was impossible with the beasts camped around his tree. His only hope was to bide his time, then climb down and creep past them while they slept. Suddenly it occurred to him that he could use the situation to his advantage, by sneaking a little closer to the fires. If he could eavesdrop on the orcs' conversation, he might learn something of their plans. He was familiar with their language in its written form, at least. It paid to have been raised by a magus with a very large library. Studying was his favorite occupation, after working in the forge. Unlikely as it might sound, there was a logic to the grunts, snarls, and shouts that passed for orcish communication. Scholars had studied the speech of orcs in captivity and discovered a language with an unusual emphasis on curses and threats. His heart raced at the prospect of stealing closer to the stinking beasts. He would be finished if they caught him. But a dwarf was obliged to do everything in his power to protect the races of Gerdlegard from Teon's ugly hordes. The smith's commandments applied to every single one of his children, and that meant Tungdil too. His mind was made up. He eyed the trunk, looking for the best way of reaching the ground without making any noise. Even as he was lashing his bags to the tree, a commotion sounded below. One by one, the orcs rose to their feet amid a tumult of shouted exclamations. Guests were approaching. The ring of orcs closed around the tree. The dwarf edged away from the trunk, crawling as far along the tapering branch as he dared. At last he was close enough to hear what they were saying, provided he strained his ears. Thankfully, the chieftains were forced to raise their voices above the din, which made things a little easier. He reached out gingerly and pushed the leaves aside. The beasts were gathered in a large circle around three chieftains, whose fearsome tusks had been sharpened and tattooed. At once the noise died down, the cheering fading into silence. Tungdil heard the clatter of horseshoes. Two riders made their way through the ranks of waiting orcs, the hooves of their black steeds striking the ground in a shower of blue and white sparks. The crimson-eyed horses moved with feline fluidity and had nothing of the typical equestrian gait. The tall, slender riders directed their steeds to the center of the circle and dismounted. Tungdil's instincts told him they were Elfar. The creatures were clad in finely tailored leather armor, and from their shoulders hung long cloaks. Their black leather breeches were tucked into dark brown boots that reached above their knees, and their hands were sheathed in burgundy gloves. The first of the pair, an elf with long fair hair, held a spear tipped with a head as fine as an icicle. A sword dangled from his belt. His companion's hair was pulled away from his face, his dark plait disappearing into the mantle of his cape. He carried a longbow in his hand, and a quiver of arrows on his back. A pair of daggers was lashed to his thighs, with leather straps. Tungdil recognized the elf at once. It was the face he had seen at the window of the tavern.
"Please, Vrakas," he begged silently. "May Fridigard and Vrabor be alive."
The fair-haired elf took charge of the proceedings, speaking in the common tongue. It was clearly below his race's dignity to communicate in the primitive grunts of the orcs.
I am Synthoris of Tion Balsur, here at the command of my master, Nodon the Doublefold, commander of the perished land, to present the three princes of Toboribor with an offer of an alliance. His voice was cold, barely courteous. He was there to present a deal, and his tone told them they could take it or leave it. Prince Bashkug, Prince Kragnar, Prince Ushnots, you have been chosen by Nodon to conduct a campaign of subjugation and destruction, the like of which has never been seen. You, the strong arm of the south, shall lead the orcs to victory and sunder the skull of mankind.
And who shall be the commander?
Demanded Kragnar, who stood as tall as the elf, but with twice his girth. The other princes were of smaller stature. Bashkug gave him an angry shove.
You think you're better than us, do you?
He shouted belligerently. Kragnar responded to the insult by lumbering round to face his challenger. He leaned across until their broad foreheads were touching. Neither moved as they stared at each other, clawed fingers clutching the pommels of their massive swords. Ushnots proved altogether wilier and took a step backward, waiting to see how the squabble would unfold.
My master intends to make you equal in rank, announced Synthoris, straining to make himself heard above the snarling.
No,
growled Kragnar quickly, promptly followed by Bashkug. The elf cast them a disgusted glance. Even from a distance, Tungdil could tell that he would rather kill the princes than negotiate with them. But Nodon had given his orders. It was the first time that Tungdil had heard mention of any name at the source of the evil. In that case, my master will grant the office of commander to whosoever conquers the most land. The elf held his spear loosely, but his taut stance betrayed his distrust of the beasts. His dark-haired companion seemed equally wary.
Land? Grunted Ushnot scornfully. It should be corpses, not land. Whoever gets the most bodies will be commander.
He stroked his belly, and the other two princes hastened to agree.
No, the elf said firmly. This is about territory, not corpses.
Why?
Thundered Bashkug.
Why not corpses? My soldiers have to eat.
Content yourselves with killing the armies that are raised against you, the elf advised him coldly. You know my master's will.
Exactly,
Ushnot said slyly.
Your master. We've no obligation to obey him. He doesn't rule the south. We do.
Synthoris directed a pitying smile at him. Not for much longer. My master is advancing from the north with an army of orcs who will seize the south faster than you can fashion cudgels from the trees. He looked each of the princes in the eye.
Give him your allegiance now, and he will reward you with land of your own. Toboribor is nothing compared with what will follow. Each one of you will have your own kingdom with humans for slaves. But defy him, and you will cross swords with others of your race.
The threat of a green-hided army from the north with designs on their territory achieved its intended effect. A hush descended as the three princes digested the information, all memory of their quarrel forgotten. From his post among the branches, Tungdil listened and watched in disbelief. Nodon, if that was the name of the perished land's lord, was forging all kinds of unholy alliances in order to subjugate the southern lands. The coming cycles would bring untold suffering for men and elves.
Fine,
Ushnot said finally, although clearly unhappy with the solution.
I shall do as your master proposes, and he shall make me commander-in-chief.
Kragnar glowered at him murderously.
Count me in as well,
he snarled.
The tribe of the Kragnar Shores will conquer more land than the two of you put together.
He jabbed a clawed finger derisively at the others.
I'll be commander, you'll see. I wouldn't bet on it,
Bashkug retorted angrily.
My troopers will overrun the fleshling cities before you've even started.
You'll all have a chance to prove yourselves, said Synthoris, reaching into his belt pouch and producing three plain amulets of blue crystal.
He tossed them to the princes.
Leave here, and go your separate ways. These are gifts from my master. They offer protection against the magic of our foes. You are to carry them always.
The meeting had almost reached its conclusion, when a foolhardy orc sidled up to the Alfar's steeds and sniffed the air hungrily. Without warning, one of the horses whipped round, jaws opening as it pounced. Sharp teeth closed around the orc's shoulders and ripped out a sizable clump of flesh. Green blood spurted from the wound as the orc retreated, shrieking. A second orcish trooper drew his sword and made to fell the rabid horse. Before he could strike, the steed's hind leg lifted and sped into the orc's broad chest. There was a flash of blinding light, and the orc was thrown backward, traveling several paces before crashing to the ground. The trooper had no time to right himself before the second horse was upon him. Its foreleg stove in his chest, hollowing his breastplate. His stomach burst with a sickening bang. In an instant, the creature's black jaws were at the orc's unprotected throat. There was a sound of crunching bone, and the orc's anguished screaming broke off abruptly. Tungdil watched in stunned horror as the steed swallowed the mouthful of flesh. The second creature let out a whinny of savage enjoyment. The fair-haired elf issued an order in an unintelligible language, and the steeds, horses in nothing save appearance, settled down at once, trotting obediently to their masters. The elfar swung themselves gracefully onto their backs.
"You know what my master expects of you. Make haste, and keep to the terms of our agreement,"
Synthoris said grimly, turning his steed to leave. A wide corridor opened before him as the crowd parted hastily, drawing back from the animal's lethal jaws. At length, the silence was broken. The orc with the wounded shoulder shoved his way to the front.
"Look what they did to me!"
he shouted furiously, waving his gore-encrusted claws in Bashkug's face.
"The pointy ears killed Ragnar! The pointy ears deserve to die!"
The powerfully built chieftain wiped the trooper's blood from his eyes.
"Hold your tongue, you cretin!"
he thundered, adding a string of foul-mouthed epithets.
"They're with us! In us, I reckon, we'll eat them like we'll eat the fleshlings!"
The threat brought grunts of approval from three of his tribe. Emboldened by their support, he knocked an arrow to his bow and took aim at the vanishing riders.
What's tastier, Alfar or horse?"
Tungdil knew better than to mistake the mounts for horses. He had read about shadow mares in Lot Ionan's books. They were creatures of the night, unicorns who had been possessed by evil and stripped of their purity, their white coats and their horns. They ate flesh and were ferocious hunters, driven by an all-consuming hatred of goodness in any form. Bashkug was tired of the trooper's posturing. Drawing his clumsily forged sword, he struck at the wounded orc's throat. The blade sliced halfway through the neck, withdrawing with a vicious jerk. The prince grabbed the second orc and hewed his head from its shoulders, holding it aloft for the others to see. With a terrible warning cry, he bared his fangs and dropped the dripping skull, grinding it into the ground, until dark grey brains oozed through splintered bone. The other two orcs who had joined in the rebellion were put to the sword as well. The matter had been resolved in the traditional orcish way. Cowed by the display of might, the troopers skulked back to their campfires, grunting and snarling, to resume their victory celebrations. The five bloodied corpses of their comrades, one trampled by the shadow mare and four slaughtered by the prince, were abandoned where they lay.
"What now?"
Ashnots wanted to know.
"I'll go south,"
decided Kragnar.
"You,"
he said, pointing to Bashkug,
"head west, while Ashnots takes care of the east."
The others nodded their assent.
"What do we do about the fleshling settlement?"
"I say we attack together,"
Ashnots said greedily.
"It's not far, and we can get a quick feed before we go our separate ways."
Bashkug scratched his chin doubtfully.
"Didn't the elf tell us not to?"
"The southern lands are our business, not theirs. Besides, this wasn't part of the deal. The elf told us to conquer new territory. This is ours already."
He smiled slyly.
"The fleshlings skewered my troopers' skulls on their palisade. I want revenge,"
roared Kragnar, his breastplate jangling as he thumped his brawny chest.
"No elf can stop me from punishing them." "At dawn, then," proposed Bashkug, to a chorus of approving grunts.
Tungdil let the twigs spring back and retreated slowly along the branch. He had heard enough to know that Gerdlegard was in serious danger. But before he could warn Lotionen about Nodon's designs, he had to sound the alarm in Goodwater and deliver the bag to Gorin. The Magus would know what to do about the threat. He would probably call a meeting of the council, or, better still, summon the rulers of the human kingdoms as well. It seemed to Tungdil that it was time for the Magi and the human sovereigns to join forces against the perished land. They could even ask the dwarves to help them. A combined army, bolstered by his kinsfolk, would surely be victorious. Tungdil waited until all but a handful of orcs were asleep, but even then there was no guarantee that his escape would be successful. 3 dozen orcs had been posted around the camp's perimeter to keep watch for intruders. The dwarf took a deep breath and decided on his route, picking a particularly bored and sleepy-looking sentry who had propped himself on his rusty spear and was fighting to stay awake. After a good deal of deliberation, he resolved to take his packs with him. In view of his recent bad luck, it seemed too risky to leave them in the tree. The orcs would only discover them, and the last thing he needed was to lose the precious artifacts and admit his failure to Lotionen and Gorin. An eternity seemed to pass as Tungdil abandoned his hiding place as quietly as possible. Even the rustling of a branch would seal his fate. He kept hold of the firm bark with both hands, sliding down gradually and taking care to avoid the light of the fire. Every now and then a twig would snag on his chainmail, but he succeeded in prising himself free without a telltale snapping of wood. At last he was back on solid ground, pressing his face into the grass and filling his nostrils with its fresh, dewy scent. It was a welcome antidote to the pungent stench of orc. Stealth had never been his strong point, so it seemed best to proceed on his belly like a caterpillar, pushing the bags in front of him while endeavoring to keep his posterior out of sight. It turned out to be much harder than he'd hoped. The haft of his axe was forever jamming between his legs, his chainmail jangled with the slightest movement, and his boots struggled to find purchase on the slippery grass. His nerves were in tatters. "I knew it was a terrible climber, but trying to be quiet is worse," he thought, stopping to mop the sweat from his brow. Vrakas had intended the dwarves to fight in open combat. They took deliberate strides to get wherever they were going, and built staircases when the gradient dictated. There was none of this sneaking around. Barely 10 paces separated the dozing sentry from Tungdil as he slithered past. Every feature of the trooper's hideous countenance was visible in the moonlight. Its face was crisscrossed with war paint and ceremonial scars, and milky saliva dribbled out of its mouth and down its protruding tusks, dripping onto its fat slabbered armor. The nostrils in its flat nose flared from time to time. The dwarf was tempted to bury his axe in the beast's oafish head, but he doubted his proficiency, and in any case, one dead orc would scarcely save Goodwater from attack. Relieved to be out of the camp, he crawled through the grass until he reached an irrigation channel at the edge of the field and slipped inside, disappearing from view. The ditch allowed him to reach the fringes of a wood without being seen, and at last it was safe to stand up. Now that was an adventure by anyone's standards. His clothes were coated in mud, but he had other, more pressing concerns. As far as he could recall, the wood was fairly small, and the best course was to cut straight through it. He hoped to goodness that he wouldn't lose his way. Having put a decent distance between himself and the orcs, Tungdil stopped worrying about trying to move quietly. Provided he could get to the village fast enough, there was still a chance that lives could be saved. He settled into a steady trot and reached the edge of the wood in short order. With a sigh of relief, he stepped out into the open.
"Vrakas almighty!"
he froze at the sight. 400 paces from the wood was another orc encampment, 3 times larger than the first. The field was carpeted with sleeping beasts. No fires were alight to alert him to the danger. Tungdil retreated quickly before he was spotted. In spite of his best efforts, he failed to find an alternative route. If he wanted to reach the settlement, he would have to sneak past the sleeping bodies. Soon his misgivings were replaced by dwarven obstinacy. Determined to warn the villagers of the coming danger, he crept along the edge of the wood, trying to stay hidden while he picked out the best path through the camp. Suddenly, his boot met with resistance, and he heard a faint click. Leaves swirled into the air, and a metal jaw snapped shut, trapping his left calf just below the knee. The ground opened, and Tungdil plummeted downward, landing head first. Everything went dark. It was the pain that woke him. When Tungdil came to, there was an excruciating throbbing in his left leg. Groaning, he struggled into a sitting position and gazed up at the dark earthen walls. Gleaming green fronds framed the opening of the pit. It was dawn already. Clamped to his leg and strangling his blood supply was a contraption whose purpose he knew only too well. Villagers set traps like these to catch wolves. The metal teeth had pierced his leather breeches, leaving a crust of dark red blood around the wound. His calf throbbed dully. Tungdil did not bother to prise the trap apart, but took up his axe, gritted his teeth, and set about hammering the thin pins at the heart of the spring. Every blow to the trap was a blow to his leg, and he moaned softly in pain. Trying not to flinch, he worked on the metal determinedly until the jaws fell open and the pressure was released. With cautious movements, he removed the trap, then flung it away furiously. Using the loamy wall to support himself, he stood up and placed his injured leg gently on the ground. Pain seared through his calf. Running was out of the question. Hauling himself out of the pit was going to be difficult enough. His concern for the people of Goodwater gave him the necessary strength. After tossing his knapsack out of the pit, he slung the leather pouch over his shoulder and wound his fingers around the roots protruding from the soil. Gasping, he hauled himself up, and with a final burst of energy, swung himself onto the grass, where he lay panting for air.
"I'll be more careful where I put my feet in the future," he thought grimly.
After a while, he crawled to the edge of the wood. The fresh scent on the spring breeze was all the evidence he needed that the orcs had moved on. The field was deserted. There could be little doubt where they had gone. Smoke was rising in the distance, gathering like a storm cloud in the sky. Tungdil scrambled up, shouldered his knapsack, and hurried off, shaking the dead leaves and mud from his hair. Anger and loathing dulled the pain, driving him faster and faster until he realized that he was running after all. He wanted to be there with the people of Goodwater, since his clumsiness had prevented him from warning them in time.